I'm amazed to see all of these preachers that are gotten so old. How does that happen, Terry?
I don't know. You're
older than I am. No, I only look older. I think he's got me by a year or two yet. Well, it is a privilege to be here again. I've enjoyed being a part of the West Virginia School of Preaching for lo these many years, since 1994. And the Hillview Terrace Congregation and the Salem Church are both very close to my heart. I've had three heart surgeries. maybe that's what the problem is. But God has blessed us abundantly, and the song that we sang this morning, "The Lord Has Been Mindful of Me," that's kind of defines my life as much as any song that I know. However, Bruce and I and Judy and Gail, we were singing "Till the Storm Passes Over," during the hurricane that went over not too long ago. Wasn't too bad, if you discount that big limb that hit the roof. Andy has assigned me Psalm 88. Psalm 88 is described by the Cambridge Bible as the saddest psalm in the Psalter. And so it is as sad as the 87th psalm is glad. They are really two opposites that are back to back, but it is a we'll talk some more about that in a moment. I ran across this when Andy assigned me my topic, and I went to my file cabinet and got out my folder on the Psalms and looking at some things. I found this written by Jack Vansel, Harding Graduate School of Religion, in their bulletin in March of 1985. And I thought it was just a real appropriate thing. He said, "No book of the Bible has been studied more consistently and by more people than the book of Psalms. There is a clear reason for this interest. Here is a collection that speaks the language of men. Here are hymns and laments which reach to the heights as well as to the depths of the soul. They touch all the emotions. Sometimes strange and often difficult, the Psalms never lack the power to plumb human thought and feeling." And I think that's just a really great statement about the Psalms and how important they are to us as we read many, many centuries after the time that they were written, and how pertinent, how relevant they still are. And every one of the Psalms can touch our emotions and touch our lives in some way that just builds us up or encourages us or tells us something about the Messiah that was to come, or his church, or some aspect of things that we hold dear to our hearts in our time. In the psalm, most of the psalms have a title. Many of the titles don't really tell us much. They're not intended to, I guess. But this one has a lot to say, and I think that it'll help us to understand this psalm a little bit if we look at it. And so we read the title, and it simply says in the New King James Version, a psalm of the sons of Korah, for the chief musician, set to Mathalath-Leonoth, a contemplation of Heman the Ezrahite. Now, Mathaloth, means that has the meaning of sickness. Leonoth pertains to singing or a song. And so it is a song about sickness. We might even call it a dirge or a funeral song. And so it is also, when we talk about that it is a contemplation of Heman, a contemplation is from the Hebrew word maskil, which means to study. And so it is a song pertaining to sickness and sadness and sorrow that is to be sung, but it also offers things that can teach us. It is to be studied. And then we see this Heman, the Ezrahite. Heman is identified in the book of 1 Kings and again in 2 Chronicles as being a man who is a musician and a wise man. Now, as to who the psalm is talking about, we really don't know. Is Heman writing this from his own personal experience? I don't think so. Not simply because as a musician, he would, the way this psalm describes things, I don't think that he was a musician. I don't think that he was a sick musician. Ill. There are a lot of sick musicians. But and the fact that he is described as a wise man, I think that he is the one that God, through the Holy Spirit, had write this psalm, but it doesn't necessarily mean that it's something that he is experiencing personally. I think he is writing perhaps about somebody that he knows, or writing in a general way that identifies many people who suffer. This title helps us to see some good things. As I said, the Cambridge Bible identifies it as the saddest psalm in the Psalter, and Leupold, in his commentary on the psalm, says it is the gloomiest psalm found in the Scriptures. Oh, what we have in store. It's not going to be one of those tearjerker things, I don't think, when we study this out. Brother Roy Deaver, in his little commentary set, outlines this psalm in a very good way. He sees 5 points in it, and so the first 2 verses is the cry. O Lord, God of my salvation, I've cried out to you. And so the first 2 verses, the cry. In the verses 3-5 is the condition of this man that is being described. And then the cause. Why is he suffering so? The cause, verses 6-9. And then he has questions, verses 10-12. And then a conclusion, verses 13-18. And so the opening words, he says, O Lord, God of my salvation, I have cried out day and night before you. Let my prayer come before you. Incline your ear to my prayer, for my soul is full of troubles, and my life draws near to the grave. I am counted with those who go down to the pit. I am like the man who has no strength, adrift among the dead, like the slain who lie in the grave, whom you remember no more, and who are cut off from your hand. The opening line describing the Lord God of my salvation. In the Old Testament, and I'm sure every Bible student has noticed, that there the word Lord is either all capitalized or capital L and then small ORD. There's a difference in the Lord's being described. Capital Lord with all the capitals is what the American Standard Version translates as Yahweh, Jehovah. And so, if I understand correctly, this is the name of God. This is the personal God of Israel. And he is the sovereign God. Several speakers have talked about the sovereignty of God. And so who this poor man is crying out to is the God who is great above all gods, as chapter 1:15 emphasized. He is the sovereign God that said, "Let there be light," and there was light. He is the sovereign God that that created the heavens and the earth. He spake and it was done. He commanded and it stood fast. He is the God that set the limit to the seas. You know, I don't fear climate change. You know, that's been going on ever since creation. The Bible talks about the fact that God set the limits as to what the oceans and the seas can do. I was stationed in Thule, Greenland, back a few years ago, many years ago. That ice cap is 10,000 feet thick. So some of it has melted. Has the levels of the ocean risen, like they say? Nah, I don't worry about those things. God is going to keep things under his control. But this God who is sovereign, who causes nations to rise and fall, and that sent his beloved Son into the world to die for man's sin as the only propitiation that would count for anything. He is the God of my salvation. And so he is confident that God, Jehovah, hears his prayers, and that what he prays to God is being heard. Now, he does not know what God is going to do about any of the things that he has prayed, but he has the confidence that God hears and knows. It reminds me of the three Hebrew children in the book of Daniel, chapter 3. When they were threatened to be thrown into the fiery furnace, he said, if you don't bow down to the golden image, you're going to go into the fire. And they replied, our God is able to deliver us, and he will deliver us. But if he doesn't deliver us, we're still not going to bow down. And so that's the kind of confidence that this man in this prayer has. And so though he calls out to the Lord day and night, yet there has been no reply. He complains that he is full of troubles. My soul is full of troubles, and my life draws near to the grave. It seems that this man has whatever problem he has, his physical problem may be, he is depending upon God to deliver him. But if he does not, I'm sure that he is ready to meet his Maker. He says that he feels like he's adrift. He says, I am counted with those that go down to the pit, and he is adrift among the dead, like the slain who lie in the grave. His friends look at him as if he is already dead. His life in whatever position that he is so confined that any visitors that come just are pretty much there to observe, maybe to see is he still breathing, but they're giving no comfort, it seems, and he just feels like he is drifting, and he is as one who is ready to just pass from this mortal coil. The psalm is unique in that it uses four different terms for the grave: Sheol, the pit, and the grave, and Abaddon, or Abaddon, I should say, Abaddon. Jeremiah used similar words. He said, "He has made me dwell in darkness like the dead of long ago. He has walled me about so that I cannot escape. He has made my chains heavy. Though I call and cry for help, he shuts out my prayer. He has blocked my ways with blocks of stone. He has made my paths crooked." Jeremiah 3, verses 6 through 9. There is a hint when we look at verses 6 through 9 that perhaps his illness has come upon him as a result of sin, although that is not stated, and it may be presumptuous to even assume that. But he says that he has, "Your wrath lies heavy upon me, and you have afflicted me with all your waves." One of the great things about this psalm is he does not attribute his problems to mankind, that somehow men have abused him to cause him to be in this condition. But at the same time, he says God has afflicted him, but yet he does not speak against God. You know, a lot of times people will blame the Lord for their problems. When they get sick, they pray, and or at least they say that they pray, and God didn't deliver me, and so they are going to never pray to God again, or they're never going to worship God again. And but this poor man is not in that sort of condition. Sin has been the cause of many people suffering. The sins that men commit many times cause them to have some illness, some disease, sexual abuse, alcohol abuse, drug abuse. All of these are rampant in our country and is certainly attributable to much of the suffering and illness that people experience in our time. Now, whether this man had some experience like that, we don't know. It isn't stated. Personally, I don't think that that's the case. Why some people suffer, we don't really know. I have known people that through the years that they seem to have had some physical difficulty nearly all of their lives. One of the best men that I ever knew up in Columbus had served as an elder in the church. He preached, but as a boy, he got his eye shot out with a BB gun. It really happened. And he had polio, and so he was crippled all his life, walked with crutches. But, you know, he rose to be the head of the civil service for the city of Columbus. He did all the hiring and firing of policemen and firemen. And so he made a great success, and he was a great Christian man. He was a good counselor to me as a young preacher. But he had troubles. He had sickness. His wife had a paralysis that came over her, and her face was paralyzed. Can you imagine not being able to have facial expression and movement? But those are the kind of things that happen in life. And why did they happen? Well, I don't know. And neither do doctors and so forth. Now, Jesus suffered through no fault of his own. Job, Stephen, and others, Bible persons, suffered, but not because of their wrongdoing, but by the abuse of men. And sometimes that becomes our lot in life. Romans 8:28, and we know that all things work together for good to them that love the Lord, to those who are the called according to his purpose. We have to sometimes just accept things as they are. We can weary ourselves to death trying to figure out what happened and why this went wrong and why I can't do this and others can. We just need to accept sometimes that this is the way that it is and go on at least as much as we can. Do what we can. Some commentators think that he might have had leprosy. As we know, leprosy, especially in the Old Testament and in the New, had no cure at that time. What we call today Hansen's disease, the only cure for it in Bible times was if it was cured with a miracle. Miriam, Moses' sister, was cured of leprosy. Naaman was cured of leprosy. And in the New Testament, Jesus cured those 10 men of leprosy in Luke 17. But again, we don't know that he was being punished by God or that God had afflicted him with this, but some would think that would be the problem. But in his prayer, he reminds us, I have called daily upon you, stretching out my hands to you, in verse 9. And so he says, my eye wastes away because of affliction. And so he says, he has raised up his hands. I have called daily upon you, I've stretched out my hands to you. In our time, we have people that say they are raising holy hands. I don't know that this is this or what Paul writes in 1 Timothy 2 has anything to do with literally raising one's hands. Personally, I think it's a metaphor that what the person is doing is the one praying is saying to God, see my hands. The life that I have lived, the purity of life that I have lived. And it isn't anything of lifting up hands and dancing around. That's, I don't think that that's part of it. But rather it's a person saying to God, examine my life and see that I have lived and am living righteously and godly. I think we can do that and be right. And so, in verses 10 through 12, Heman asks several rhetorical questions. And he says, will you work wonders for the dead? Shall the dead arise and praise you? Shall your loving kindness be declared in the grave, or your faithfulness in the place of destruction? Shall your wonders be known in the dark, and your righteousness in the land of forgetfulness? These are rhetorical questions, and they are simply asked in an effort to provoke God to give an answer to his complaint and to his suffering. But emphatically, we have to say, no, God does not do wonders. He does not do his mighty works for the dead. He does it for those who are the living, to those who can praise his name, to those who can be thankful and glorify him for the greatness that he has done. And so it's among the living that his greatness and works are performed, his praise is sung, and his constancy and acts of deliverance exhibited. Death is no exponent of the glory of God. Only living men can glorify God. And our brethren in previous lessons have very well told us about the need for always being able to praise and glorify the God of heaven. But his complaint goes on and on. Again, in verse 13, "But to you I have cried out, O Lord, and in the morning my prayer comes before you." And so this suggests that that he starts his prayer early in the day. He isn't late in summoning God or approaching God, but he is one that is early to do so. In the book of 2 Chronicles, the very last chapter, the writer is giving a reason for God's deliverance of the people of Judah and Israel into the hands of Nebuchadnezzar. And he said that he sent his prophets early. God did not wait until it was too late before sending the prophets and trying to get them to motivate the people to come back to God. He sent them early. And obviously they stayed late. They preached right up like Jeremiah, right to the time of Nebuchadnezzar's breaking down of the walls of Jerusalem. And so this man prays. And he says, "I started early. O Lord, why do you cast off my soul? Why do you hide your face from me?" He says, "I have been afflicted and ready to die from my youth." Just think of that. Here is a man that, as some of these that I described earlier, that seemed to have trouble all their life. And so from his youth, he has had suffering. He has had pain. And thus he says, "I have been afflicted and ready to die from my youth. I suffer your terrors. I am distraught. They come around me all the day long like water. They engulfed me altogether." I live about 4 miles from the Atlantic Ocean, and often we go over and watch the waves coming in, and I like to go especially in the morning before the sun comes up, but I don't get to do it very often. But the waves, usually they're pretty peaceful, but they roll on and on. This one comes and goes, and there's one right behind it. It's a marvelous thing, the ocean that God made. But when a storm comes up, and the waves are high, and the riptide is dangerous, you don't want to be in the water in those kind of times. But God's might is demonstrated in the sea. "Your fierce wrath hath gone over me. Your terrors have cut me off," just like the waves coming and ever in coming. "They came around me all day long like water. They engulfed me altogether. Loved one and friend you have put far from me, and my acquaintances into darkness." This pretty well covers the complaint of this man, but I want to now talk briefly about some of the lessons that can be learned. The first is that prayer is always available to God's children. Whoever we are, no matter our health, good or bad, we are all able to pray because we have a Father in heaven. Jesus taught us to pray, "Our Father in heaven." Do you know how special that is to be able to call God Father? I love to hear men pray. There are some men that just cause you to stop and think. But I love to hear them say, "Our Father." Brother Kenneth Hoover held a lot of meetings for us out at Salem. And I think might have been the very last time that he was with us. He talked about prayer, and he described prayer as traveling on your knees. He said, "By traveling on our knees, we can lift up our hearts and voices to the very God of heaven. Go anywhere in the world, to any country, enter into any closed door, behind any locked gate, reach the greatest authority in the universe. Prayer knows no bounds. It's not limited by time zones or poor internet service. It is available night and day. Prayer is not bound by the restrictions that may be put on the physical body, sick beds, prison bars, steamy jungles, or Arctic cold." In the second place, prayer has been described as man's last resort. This seems to be the situation that the writer of this psalm finds himself in. It's his death song, if you will. He says he has cried out day and night for relief from his suffering, but none has come. And so, as Brother Eddie Kloher says, this believer has no place to turn but to God. By the time you get to my age, you will find yourself in those kind of situations. I had a surgery over in Morgantown, and all of my family was there. This was my first surgery, and son-in-law that was an elder here. Paul's son-in-law that preached in Winchester, Virginia at the time was there. And he came and saw us all there. And so he had a prayer for me and all of our family. Scott, yes. What's his last name? but that meant so much to me. You know, we have good doctors. We have good medicine. All of those things are good, but God is the last resort. We go to God in prayer. When strength fails, when money fails, when doctors fail, when all resources and possibilities are gone, God is still there, and prayer is still available. Prayer bypasses the red tape and the dead ends. It hurdles the barriers, obstacles, and frustration. It overcomes the cannots, the negatives, and the impossibles. Prayer goes to the highest authority, to God the Father, the last resort, our last and only hope. Heman's friends are much like Job's friends, who seem to have no bedside etiquette. You remember Job's friends that came and they blamed Job for all of the misery that had come upon him, and they didn't really know what they were talking about. But they spoke of him in the past tense, giving him up for dead while he was still living. And this seems to be the case here. I am counseled with those who go down to the pit. He says, my soul is full of troubles and my life draws near to the grave. And so they treated him as if he was dead. For those of you who visit hospitals, don't talk about the person lying there with their eyes closed as if they can't hear you or know what you're talking about. Speak words of comfort. Speak words of hope. Speak confident words of the love of God. Don't speak as if they're already gone and have no hope. Who may benefit from studying Psalm 88? Everybody, of course, can benefit by studying the Bible. But surely there is a special lesson for those who are chronically ill, for those that have had a sickly life, or who suffer constant pain, or those who are bedfast or wheelchair bound. Here is a psalm for them. And they need your help. This man in this psalm prayed. I can pray. This man in this psalm endured. I can endure. This man trusted God, come what may. I can do that. And so situations in life in which we're called upon, sometimes we have to have sheer determination. What I would call real grit for love of life. I think that's pulled a lot of people through when everybody else gave up on them. God taught us to love life. He gave us life. He wants us to live. And we will live as long as our body allows us, and as long as God allows us. But we have to have a determination to survive sometimes. This is a psalm enabling us to prepare for death. Sometimes we have to face the cruel reality that, yes, our life is going to be over. We don't like to think about things like that. But do you know, I have seen people and I visited hospitals where the person in that bed sees death as a friend rather than a foe, simply because they have suffered so long and can endure no more, and they are ready. My poor mother died at age 48 of stomach cancer. She wasted away. She went from 120 pounds to, I think, 60 pounds when she died. Sometimes people are ready to go on to their Maker. Death is not something we seek, but age creeps upon us. Life itself can become a burden. For some, death becomes less a fear and more a friend. I think that I have gone past my time. Andy, I apologize, Scott. But read the book. Maybe you'll get something from it. Thank you very much. Appreciate you listening.